This episode of Cut the Clutter is being recorded exactly on the day when the war in Ukraine has finished, completed its 12 weeks. 12 weeks. 12 weeks for a war which the whole world thought will not last more than a couple of days or maybe a week at the most. It was expected that this massive Russian military machine will roll in. They were already on the outskirts of Kyiv, say in the first 48 hours of the war, it seemed. They had taken an air base, apparently very close to Kyiv, and looked like they were going to run over all of Ukraine. And it was a matter of time, hours, before the will of the defenders will break and Ukrainian government will surrender or sue for peace, or Zelensky will escape. Also, there was widespread belief that the city of Kharkiv, which is sort of the closest to the Russians when they come in from the east and also say from Belarus side, that city will fall. That's the second largest city in Ukraine. In fact, even on day one of the war, looked like that it was falling. But no such thing has happened. Not only are the Russians now, they've been driven so far away from Kyiv. In fact, they've carried out very quick, almost a panicky withdrawal, although they are trying to put on a brave face by saying that this is a tactical withdrawal, this was a tactical feint or deception to draw Ukrainian armies away. But even if the purpose was to draw Ukrainian armies away, they have no gains to show for it elsewhere on the battlefield. The battlefield right now is frozen. Russians and Ukraine have been stalemated. For Ukrainians, a stalemate is victory. Because for the much weaker power, a stalemate is a victory before the opponent or the attacker has achieved any major objective. There is nothing that the Russians can now pick up and say, this is what I'd come for, I'm claiming victory and I'm ending the war. That possibility simply isn't there. If anything, Ukrainians, in fact, advancing from the Kharkiv area, they are pushing at the Russian border. They've reached the Russian border in places. There are pictures also of Ukrainian soldiers picking up border pillars and reinstalling them. And maybe if they want to be cheeky, even moving towards town of Belgorod in Russian territory. And remember, this is the place where they have occasionally, again, out of cheekiness maybe, and also to convey a tactical and psychological message, used helicopters to drop incendiaries and bombs over the air base there. So you never know where that's ending. This war has not followed any script that anybody may have written before it started, because Russia is a global military power. It's a military superpower. So much tamjham, bandobast that NATO had put together in the plains of Europe, that was visualizing this massive threat, this nightmare of thousands of Russian tanks rolling down the plains of Central Europe. That NATO had no wherewithal to handle without America's help. And even that was always considered a challenge. The same great tank army now is getting its comeuppance in the battlefields, the same plain, flat battlefields of Ukraine. Plain, flat battlefields where wide spaces are available for maneuver, where large bodies of armor and mechanized forces can operate, but also where there is very little space to hide. So you would have thought that in such a situation, a much bigger force, particularly one willing to take casualties like the Russians, they will win quite easily. But that, as we can see now, has not happened. So where do we stand now, and what are the lessons we learn from this Russia-Ukraine war, or frankly, what should more aptly be called the Russian invasion of Ukraine that has gone wrong? It has gone wrong. Governments, big powers, even super big powers like Russia can make miscalculations, can make mistakes. But as military, strategic, political, geopolitical mistakes or blunders go, this is perhaps the biggest in modern history, maybe in the history of the world since Second World War. Because when the Russians started this, when Putin started this, this was not on the books. Now, how did this come about? What are the things that have happened, or what are the factors which have brought us to this situation, which have brought Putin to a standstill with no real gain, having suffered such heavy losses, which has got little Ukraine still fighting, and which has got all of the Europeans now unite in a manner that the Russians never wanted them united. In fact, that's an issue that we'll talk about in the course of time, not today, some other time. The fact that how Sweden and Finland are now joining NATO formally, they've both said it formally, and they are going through their internal clearances and processes in parliament, etc. And how even the Swiss neutrality seems to have shaken. So this has been a comprehensive geostrategic and geopolitical defeat for the Russians. But underlying this is a military stalemate, which for all practical purposes so far at the conclusion of day 12 of the war is a defeat for the Russians. In fact, if anything, I've seen this widely shared clip from a discussion on Russian TV, where a Russian expert, a well-known Russian defense columnist, a former colonel, Mikhail Khodoryanok, he's saying that, look, this is nonsensical of anybody to say that Ukrainians have lost their morale, etc., etc., and victory is now very close for us. No such thing is happening. Ukrainians are fighting. Many people fight to defend their own country, and they have the weaponry to do it. They can last a long time, and because Ukrainians are getting volunteers, they can now put an army of 1 million people in the field. They may not be professional soldiers, but professionalism is not all about training and about being conscripted in the army. It also comes from how strongly are you willing to give away your life to defend your nation or not. And he also says the big problem that the Russians now face is this complete international isolation. So that's where Russia has come. As I said, underlying this is Russian military's failure to achieve its objectives quickly. If, as they had done in Crimea in 2014, they had quickly taken what they wanted, got the government to fall in Ukraine, brought about a regime change, the whole world would have lumped it. They would have protested. There might have been some sanctions going on for some more time, but sanctions have been going on since the Crimean invasion also. But Russian military has failed at it. And what is the reason? Now, there are a bunch of factors. And I will list these to you. Some of it, I must give credit where it's due. It's also inspired by a show on the BBC under the Newsnight series. And I have read up the rest, and I'm making some Indian comparisons and speaking from whatever knowledge I might have. Because this war is an indication that this is a very profound change in the nature of modern warfare. In fact, this BBC show quotes General Richard Barron, who's a former commander of UK Joint Forces Command between 2013 and 16, he in fact says that this signals the most profound change in the nature of warfare in 150 years. Now, he's a military general and scholar, so he must have reasons to say 150 years. I'm not so knowledgeable on military history, at least not in so much detail. So I will not say 150 years, but at least, if you see, since the Second World War, this is the biggest change. And what are the elements that are bringing about this change? So we talked about tanks the other day. Tanks, it was seen, were the kings of battle, right? Bash on regardless. By the way, that is the motto of the 54th Infantry Division of Indian Army. So bash on regardless, which means I have 100 tanks, you have 100 tanks, let's go into battle in open fields. I'll use my tactics and maneuver, use your tactics, maneuver, firepower, range, whatever. In the end, a lot of us will get knocked out, but the side that is left with one tank will win the battle. Now, what happens if the other side is not fighting you with tanks? Conventionally, you would have thought that if the other side is not fighting you with tanks or enough tanks, that means you will roll them over and you will win the war quite easily. What Ukraine has shown that is now a thing of the past, because the cost of defense against capital assets. What are capital assets in a modern battlefield? It's tanks, it's fighter aircraft with human beings inside them, pilots, that is manned aircraft, whether jets or helicopters, attack helicopters, or ships in the waters, submarines. These are capital assets. Now, the price of taking down a capital asset has become a fraction of having to use another capital asset to bring it down. Ships stopped fighting each other with artillery, with guns a long time back. But now you can in any case take down a ship. You don't even need a navy to take down a ship, as Ukrainians have shown with Moscow. One missile for the price, which is metaphorically equivalent of pocket change compared to the value of a ship, can take it down. Similarly, a missile worth a few thousand dollars can take down a full main battle tank, even a T-90, which is the most modern the Russians have, and also fry the people or vaporize the people inside it. So these missiles, these low-weight, shoulder-fired missiles, most of them, or dropped from drones, they are now so effective against tanks that they are not just knocking out the tanks, as in making them immobile, so at least people can escape from inside them. But it's just completely turning them inside out. Turrets are going flying 30 feet, 40 feet, 100 feet high. If you watch these videos, it does look like the era of the tank is over. And that we talked about in an earlier episode of Cut the Clutter also. The tanks have seemed to be a liability when faced with this kind of very cheap, very sneaky defensive weapons. So now the modern equivalent in an open battlefield of an old-time sniper is now a sniper or two carrying these anti-tank weapons, or maybe even anti-aircraft weapons. You can bring down a helicopter, you can bring down a jet aircraft that is not flying too high. If it flies too high, then it is exposed to other missiles like S-300 or S-400, say from the Russian side. Ukrainians don't have S-400s right now, and missiles of that kind. So manned aircraft also have problems, and we'll talk about that. But tanks have now become a liability. Now, is it the end of the tank era? You can't say that. It is not the end of the tank era. What this will lead to is, this will lead to improvement in the tanks, armor, mobility, etc., etc. Because this is a constant ongoing battle between tacticians, between military planners, scientists, and the military industrial complexes. So that will go on. But the fact is, we have now seen that you can defend against a mighty tank army. There wasn't an army, tank army mightier than that of the Soviet Union and its inheritor, Russia. That has now been humbled. Second, you might say, oh, maybe the Russian tanks are bad and Ukrainians are getting great tanks from the Western world, the French, the Germans, the Americans. No such thing. The Ukrainian tanks are also Russian and Soviet tanks. If anything, their tanks are a bit older than Russian tanks, and it's not as if their tanks are also being very effective, because the Russians are also able to use their own equivalent of Javelin missiles and NLAWs from their area, because what they are using, instead of these missiles fired sneakily by small bands of people, they are using heavy artillery. So that is the second thing. Artillery was always called the king of battle. We know that in battle after battle, anything between 60 to 90% casualties are all inflicted by artillery, which you can't see. It's far away. Now you might say it might be very stirring to see people charging the trenches or charging the hills or charging hill features in old days, even with bayonets and all that, throwing grenades. That's a very stirring sight. But before that, most of the job has been done by artillery. Even if you read the history of the warfare in Kargil, what was the Indian tactics? Indian tactics was to use massed artillery. At one time, it looked like as if almost 2/3 of Indian Army's Bofors guns were there. And that is what was plastering these hill features day in and day out. So they could soften the defenses or minimize the defenses, break their morale when the infantry soldiers went up there. Ultimately, infantry has to go and get it. But most of the casualties were inflicted by the artillery. Similarly, casualties from the Pakistani side were mostly inflicted by the artillery, although they didn't have that much artillery. In fact, the turning point in those battles in Kargil came when one artillery commander from the Indian side, I think Brigadier Lakhvinder Singh, if I remember his name correctly, he recalled a lesson from the history of Maharaja Ranjit Singh's battles. where Maharaja Ranjit Singh used massed artillery, that was ancient artillery, massed artillery in direct firing mode, because modern artillery fires over trajectory. So he over a trajectory. So he collected this artillery close enough to some of these features and fired in the direct mode at them. So artillery is the big killer. Russian army has been built around the artillery. Soviet army was built around massive artillery, massive guns, massive range, massive projectiles. Now, in the world wars, these were used. Say, closer home, in the India-Pakistan wars, a lot of artillery was used, a lot of ordnance was thrown, lobbed at the other side. Iran-Iraq war, for a long time, people just sat in trenches and they were throwing lobbing artillery bombs at each other. But in all those wars, this artillery was inaccurate. This artillery was a nuisance. If it hit something, it hit something. You had people going up in aircraft, air observation post, earlier small propeller aircraft, then helicopters to identify targets, let your gunners at the back know, or artillery officers were posted at lookouts to identify targets. Now, that was the early primitive way of doing it. But even then, the shells were not guided. Today's artillery, the shells are guided. Shells are laser guided. And just as artillery has learned to move in a shoot and scoot manner, shells have become much more accurate. So very often it's possible, if you have a drone up there or a satellite up there or good air surveillance and somebody can identify the target, even in the first strike, you can hit the target. And that's why we are seeing these videos or rows upon rows of Russian tanks being hit by one volley of fire, say from 5, 7 or 10 guns from the Ukrainian side. And similarly, Russian big guns, 152mm, 155mm, firing and hitting Ukrainian targets, particularly the tanks. So tanks on the Ukrainian side are also suffering heavy damage, and that's mainly happening because of artillery. It's also the use of artillery now that Ukrainians particularly, kitna minute ho gaya? 18. Now particularly as the Ukrainians are getting American M777 artillery guns, which are very good. And if you see this artillery being used, in fact, I tweeted the other day a video of this artillery gun firing in Ukraine that a Ukrainian defense journalist Ilya Ponomarenko had shared, and I'll share this with you. See, as the gun is being targeted and fired, somebody's on his laptop because the information on the target is coming in this case, most likely from a drone. So that's being fed in. Then the shell is being followed. It's all technology to make sure that shell goes to the right place. And then you might get a bomb damage assessment, or you might get a sense of how accurate the shell was. And so it goes on. So with this range, now these artillery guns today can throw a 50-60 kilometer shell over anything between 40 to 50 kilometers, but not randomly, very specifically. It might come with the address of your home on it and may deliver it more accurately than, say, DHL will deliver your courier packet or Zomato will deliver your food order, and in much less time because it will come flying at a very high speed. So this artillery, modern artillery, has also redefined the battlefield. The third thing that has redefined the battlefield, again, is something that we've spoken about, that is the drones. Because drones are not now just either collecting surveillance or dropping a few bombs in a completely protected environment, as the Americans were doing in Afghanistan, because Afghans had, or Mujahideen had, no air defenses. So they had the free reign of the countryside. They could go and drop anything, anywhere, and stay up in the air for a long time. Not just that. Drones are of many sizes now. So while publicity goes to Bayraktars and others who go and drop larger bombs and take down larger targets, smaller drones can be used. One, for surveillance. Second, for electronic jamming and counter-jamming, electronic countermeasures and counter-countermeasures, but also to drop small munitions. And can you imagine what a nuisance that can be? Now, in Ukraine is a large population, 4.5 crore. So by European standards, it's a large population. It's also a very It's also a population with very high social indicators, very good education. Ukraine, by and large, is also acknowledged to have a strong technology or information technology base. So in Ukraine now, a bunch of people built an organization. This is an amateur organization, basically amateur techies who've set up this organization called Aerorozvedka. You can see their logo and see that little slogan beneath it. Adventures of the occupiers in Kyiv, which means who are the occupiers in Kyiv? But the Russians. So basically they are saying that, see how we teach the Russians a lesson. What they've done is they built their own little drones, or they bought their own little drones. They're putting little bombs inside them, little but very lethal bombs. They're using these drones on their own in coordination with the regular armed forces. So they're keeping them informed. And these little drones are then sneaking into Russian formations and dropping this accurately over a tank, over an armored personnel carrier. And this is, it's because of this kind of fusion of intelligence, smart weapons, good minds, electronics, that Goliath has got much bigger firepower, a much bigger punch against David than it ever did. And that is another big change in the battlefield. Because what these drones are now doing is, these drones have taken deception away from large military columns. You can use any amount of camouflage. You can use any amount of other smoke screens or whatever. But these drones will come up there. They'll be too small for you to bring down or spot. And they will always find where you are. And remember, we keep saying it all the time in modern warfare, one who sees the other first wins, because both sides have long-range weapons. The next point, air power. Now, we've been conditioned to think of air power as this incredible thing, and all air forces think that they can win all wars by themselves. That it looked like that when we saw the war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, also when we've seen sometimes Israelis use their air power. But we have to remember one thing. These are situations where the country with air power is working in a totally protected environment, which means there is no challenge in the skies, either from a rival air force because of a total air superiority, as the Americans established in no time over Iraq, or because of the missiles down below. Once again, Russians faced those missiles, Stingers, etc. in Afghanistan, but Americans faced no such threat in Iraq or in Afghanistan, and Israelis face very little of that threat, if at all, because they are mostly fighting non-state actors right now. In this situation, the mighty Russian Air Force has come up against a much weaker and much smaller Ukrainian Air Force, which has preserved itself. So even after 12 weeks, Ukrainian aircraft are still flying. In fact, on the western side of Ukraine, they are flying quite a bit. And that's why Russian Air Force almost never ventures in the vast western side of Ukraine. They've been using long-range missiles yet. And long-range precision missiles are very expensive. It's also a question of how much can you manufacture and how long can you keep the war going. Because if Ukrainians have to use stuff like that, that will keep coming from NATO, from the US all the time. But the Russian Air Force's inability to control the skies, they don't. One, because of ground-based missiles. Ukrainians have S-300 type long-range missiles, but they also have now, they are now awash with shorter-range Stinger type missiles. That Russians are now almost not using manned aircraft in combat, nor are they using manned helicopters in combat. So once again, you can see what a big change has been brought about. And finally, intelligence. So I'll share with you an article. It's the part one of a study that a website that I read often, War on the Rocks, they've done. This is Intelligence and the War in Ukraine, part one by Naveen Shaban Abdullah, Philip H.J. Davis, Tristan Gustafson, Dan Lomas, Steve Wagner, bunch of bylines. So they have done this study explaining the role that intelligence is played here. And it's obvious that with NATO's help and also with all their civilians turning into a militia, Ukrainians are getting much better intelligence, which is mostly responsible for the large killings, of large-scale killings of Russian generals and field commanders in this war. Now, finally, before I let you go away, many of you have written to me about my reference to Davis Cup while talking about India's badminton Thomas Cup victory yesterday. And I had said that there was only one time when India reached the challenge round, which is like the ultimate stage when you win the championship in Davis Cup. And many people have said, no, India made the finals thrice. So here is the difference for clarity. Until, I think, late 1960s, probably till 1970 or so, Davis Cup had a different format. It did not have a knockout format. There, from each zone, you came up, and then there was a semi-final and a final. And once you won the final, you played a challenge round against the previous year's or previous championships champion. So in the earlier system, till the 60s, the champion, one year's Davis Cup champion, did not play any of the rounds for next year. They played only the challenge round. So you had to win the finals and then get to challenge round. So in 1966, the team of Ramanathan Krishnan, Premjit Lal, Jaydev Mukherjee, they won the semi-finals and finals, defeating West Germany and Brazil, and went to the challenge round against Australia in Melbourne. And that was a very formidable Australian team. They had Roy Emerson, Fred Stoll, Tony Roche. So India lost. I think India won the doubles match in that one, but India lost. After that, India has made the final twice. The format changed later. Challenge round was taken out, and then the reigning champion also had to play the whole league. In that format, in 1974, India got to the final. India had the best chance of winning Davis Cup at that time, but India squandered it. Why? Because this was a tie against South Africa in South Africa. And because India was not going to legitimize apartheid, India refused to go and gave South Africa a walkover. India had a very strong team because Amrit Raj brothers at that time were at their peak, that is Vijay and Anand. Then 1987 again, India got to the final. So I do hope that clarifies the confusion over Davis Cup final and the challenge round. Because challenge round is something that maybe you will have to be quite old like me to remember what it used to be. That there used to be a phenomenon called the challenge round.